Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks very much for coming. This is a public lecture that's being sponsored by the LSE Public Policy Group and by the MPA in Public Policy. Just to give you a quick plug, it's in its third year and we're flourishing. And I'm not sure. Yes, it is. But perhaps I need to shout more into it. Is that better? Well, today's lecture is being given by David Walker, who's the Comptroller General of the United States, and it's a very proud moment for me to introduce him, because he's the head of the world's largest and probably most important what are called supreme audit institutions. And supreme audit institutions are a kind of institution that not a lot of people have heard of. And perhaps in the old days there was a good reason for that. The body of very fine men and women whose work he supervises used to be called the General Accounting Office when it was first set up in 1921, but is now metamorphosed by a slate of the designer's hand with the same initials GAO into the Government Accountability Office, which sounds a great deal more important, and in fact it is a fantastically important institution, not only in the USA but internationally. It's a leader in government auditing and government policy evaluation, and so it's a very great pleasure to have its head with us today. But in addition, I should say that David Walker is a very distinguished US public servant who's in the middle of a 15-year term.
Great.
And as Comptroller General. And he previously was worked in federal government and has worked for Accenture and has a very glittering career that I won't try to summarize. So he's going to be talking today about whether the US budget surplus is sustainable. And I'm going to ask him to speak for about 30, 40 minutes. And he's then going to be very keen to take questions from the floor and so on.
Thank you, Professor Dunleavy. And I want to thank all the students in advance who have had something to do with putting this together. I would also like to acknowledge that I've got at least a couple of my colleagues in the audience. I've got Dr. El Madawi, who is the head of the Supreme Audit Institution in Morocco, as well as Dr. Matute, who is head of the Supreme Audit Institution in Peru. The three of us, as well as 10 other of our colleagues, were here to try to help work together to improve capacity of Supreme Audit Institutions around the world. And in total, there were actually 31 countries that were represented. And I'd also like to acknowledge that Sir John Bourne, who's my counterpart here in the UK, the Comptroller and Auditor General of the United Kingdom, is got a special relationship with the LSE, and I know he wished he could be here tonight, wanted me to pass on his regards, but he's got a conflict, and fortunately he hosted this meeting for the last several days and just did a great job. I'm going to speak, I guess, sitting down, because that way I wouldn't have a microphone otherwise. It's a little bit unusual for me. I'm not used to sitting on my duff this long. But what I will do is try to cover the material. And I really do want to save time for questions, because that, frankly, to me, is the most interesting part. But nonetheless, at the professor's request, let me provide you with about 30 minutes of opening remarks. You know, many people say that the only thing that's certain in today's world is death and taxes. And while those are certain in today's world, there's a third certainty, and that third certainty is change. Change is constant. And change is coming with increasing frequency. One vivid example is the relationship between the United States of America and Great Britain. In 1776, we had a difference of opinion with Great Britain. We fought two conflicts with Great Britain, one in 1776 and one that lasted until 1815, but yet much has changed since that point in time. And in fact, today, I would argue that we probably have no stronger ally than the United Kingdom, and that we have a number of shared interests around the world, of which Sometimes the public agrees and sometimes it doesn't. But nonetheless, it's a very valuable ally, which Americans appreciate, and I do as well. During the last century, the 20th century, the United States played an increasingly important role in world affairs, starting with Theodore Roosevelt, who was an economic conservative, a social progressive, and an internationalist. That was really the beginning of the United States being on the world stage in earnest. We grew in strength from an economic standpoint, a foreign policy standpoint, a military standpoint, and even a cultural standpoint throughout the 21st century. And at the end of World War II, largely because Europe and Japan lay in ashes, the United States actually represented over 50% of the global economy. As a student of history, however, I believe very strongly in the former philosopher George Santayana's remarks or quote that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. As history makes clear, no nation in the history of the world has maintained a dominant position indefinitely. In fact, it's likely that in the next 20 years we'll see at least one more superpower and possibly more, depending upon what happens. The key is hopefully the United States will be able to take the steps to make sure that it continues to be a superpower, but we should not fear the fact that others may arise over the years. I think we also have to keep in mind that, in my view, the greatest threat to America's future is not someone hiding in a cave in Afghanistan or Pakistan, but rather, instead, it's the widespread myopia or nearsightedness and tunnel vision that exist on behalf of U.S. policymakers, the public, and even the press. What I'm talking about is a focus on today rather than planning for tomorrow. And I'm talking about a decline in societal values and political comity, that's ITY, at home, as well as continuing ignorance and inaction on a range of known and growing challenges that are facing the United States and many other countries around the world. We have to keep in mind that there are a number of forces that are shaping our country and other countries around the world, some of which include demographic trends and economic trends. From a demographic standpoint, we face the retirement of our so-called baby boom generation, which are individuals who were born between 1946 and 1964, followed by the relative baby bust. That creates a dramatic change in the dependency ratio that will put severe strains on our fiscal policy. We are not the only country that faces these demographic realities. And in fact, there are a number of European countries who are in much worse shape than we are in this regard. Because of known demographic trends, rising health care costs, and lower federal revenues as a percentage of our economy than historically has been the case, we face large and growing structural deficits that will only increase with the passage of time unless timely and considered and serious structural reforms are enacted. I think in today's world we have to realize that no nation, including the United States, as the world's current sole superpower, should try to go it alone, because there's increasing interdependency, there are increasing number of shared challenges, from the demographic challenges to globalization of markets, enterprises, and information, new security threats, evolving technologies, and a variety of quality of life concerns. We have increasing global interdependence and accelerated integration of worldwide capital markets. We've seen a takeover offer for the London Stock Exchange just within the last few days. A recent World Bank report found that between 1990 and 2003, gross capital flows in the United States, the UK, and other EU member countries more than doubled relative to GDP. The labor markets and regulatory environments, which were once primarily driven by individual countries, are now increasingly becoming more interdependent. More and more companies are becoming global in nature. They do not seek to be identified with any particular country, and one has to keep in mind that in the private sector, which I served in for 20 years, one has a duty of loyalty to your shareholders, not a duty of loyalty to a country or countries. Perhaps the most striking aspect of the interconnectedness that we have is the globalization of information. Rapidly evolving technology has enabled instantaneous communication around the globe, and in fact, I've already been beeped once since I've been sitting here with you, although I won't look at it. The ability to stay in touch wherever you are, anywhere in the world, has had a tremendous impact on productivity, but it's also, as my wife will tell you, been an annoyance at times. But the increasing globalization of information, the rapid flow of information, quite candidly is one reason that Eastern Europe is now free, because after many years, people realized that what they had been told was not the truth, and that things weren't as had been represented by those in power. Beyond globalization, known demographic trends will decisively change both the American as well as the global landscape in 2020 and beyond. Most countries, including the United States, are aging, and diversity is increasing. In most industrialized nations, we face an increasing dependency ratio where fewer and fewer workers will support more and more retirees. In the United States, our workforce growth is slowing, but it's growing. In many European countries, it's declining. And in fact, there are European countries, including Russia, that's actually expected to have a significant reduction in the size of their population over the next 20 to 40 years. Our birth rates in the United States are such that if we had to rely upon replacing ourselves alone, we would not have population growth. The only reason we have population growth is because of our immigration policies. Most of it legal, a lot illegal, which is a different issue. So facing increasing dependency ratios, longer lifespans, at the same point in time, more and more people are wanting to retire earlier and earlier, to the point where many people actually will live longer in retirement than they worked. And that's great if you can afford it, but if you don't plan, save, invest, and preserve savings to retirement, most people will not be able to afford it, and they may not be able, they may not realize it until it's too late. Clearly, our demographic challenge is shared by Europe, Japan, and other parts of the world, as recognized by the dramatic change in dependency ratios that have occurred over the last 20 years and are projected to occur going forward. However, there is a big difference. In many European countries, and especially Asian countries, there are very high savings rates. People are recognizing that one must prepare for this growing demographic reality that is looming on our horizons. And while there are many countries in Europe that have savings rates that are in the double-digit territory, the United States has seen its savings rates decline dramatically in the last few years, to the point where in 2005, for the first time since 1933, which for those of you or who are students of history will know that that was the depth of the Depression, a global depression. For the first time since 1933, the United States had a negative personal savings rate, which meant that collectively Americans spent more than they earned during 2005. If you add to that the fact that the federal government is also dissaving by running large deficits, the combination of the two is what we call in the States a double whammy, which is not good news. Dependency ratios are changing, and combined with this fact means higher costs for social insurance programs dealing with pensions and also health. And as we all know, when health costs go up, it's not just because of demographics, it's because of intensity, it's because of utilization, and it's because of rapid expansions in technology that cause people to want to have access to the largest technology, the latest technology. There's no rationalization in healthcare. Everybody wants everything they can get as long as somebody else pays for it. And ultimately, there's a disconnect. There are changing security threats with transnational terrorist networks and rogue states armed with weapons of mass destruction. The attacks on the U.S. in 2001, the train blast in Madrid in 2004, and the bombings here in London last summer evidence the fact that it is a very dramatically different security environment than it used to be. We've had dramatic changes in technology, which I mentioned before, that have helped our productivity, enhanced quality, improved consistency, facilitated communication. There are many, many benefits. At the same point in time, there are also concerns with regard to security, with regard to privacy, and in some circumstances, quite frankly, our basic humanity. For the U.S., which is we were proud to have citizens like Thomas Edison and the Wright brothers and Jonas Salk and Bill Gates, in which the United States, which is has to compete based upon productivity, innovation, and quality. We don't want to compete on wages. If we compete on wages, that means our standard of living will go down. UK doesn't want to compete on wages. Most European and other industrialized nations don't want to compete on wages because that means a decline in your standard of living, a rush to the floor. Unfortunately, in the last year, the United States was rated number 25 in the world in math and science results. That is a big flashing red light when you're in a knowledge-based economy, and you must compete based upon brain power rather than brawn power. And by the way, brain power doesn't have an age limit. One of the most underutilized resources our country has, and virtually every country has, is our seasoned, otherwise known as senior citizens. Since I get older every year and everybody else does, I like to say seasoned rather than senior, because young gets older every year, especially when you're comparing to yourself. The quality of life for Americans and many other people in industrialized nations, including the United States, has never been better in many regards, but we have a growing and very unhealthy gap between the haves and the have-nots, not just in the United States, but in many industrialized nations and in the world at large. We have challenges such as underachieving public schools, gridlock city streets, and mounting energy, environmental, and healthcare concerns. Healthcare is probably our largest domestic challenge, which fuels a lot of our fiscal challenge. The U.S. spends double what the United Kingdom does on healthcare on a per capita basis. At the same point in time, we have growing gaps in coverage, increasing numbers of uninsured, mediocre outcomes on things like medical error rates, infant mortality, and life expectancy. If there's one thing that could swamp our ship of state, it's healthcare. And it is fueling a lot of our long-term fiscal imbalance. Candidly, our system is going to have to be dramatically and fundamentally reformed, not just the government programs, but the entire program, in installments over time, in order to make it rational and sustainable. We ration healthcare in the United States. We just don't ration it rationally. In addition, for any system to work, whether it's a governance system, a healthcare system, or a tax system, you have to have three elements in place for it to work over time. Number one, incentives for people to do the right thing. Number two, transparency to provide reasonable assurance that people will do the right thing because somebody's looking. And number three, accountability if people do the wrong thing. In the case of the U.S. healthcare system, we fail on all three counts. America has four deficits that are not only important to us, but frankly, the rest of the world. Because while we're not 50% plus of global GDP, we're still 22. We're still the largest. And the old saying goes, if America catches a cold, the rest of the world will eventually catch the flu. That's not as true today as it used to be, but there's still truth to it. While America and other countries confront many shared challenges, probably the most urgent challenge that we face
is our nation's deteriorating financial condition and long-term fiscal outlook. Our financial condition is worse than advertised. As I said before, we face large and growing structural deficits over the long term due to known demographic trends, rising health care costs, and lower federal revenues as a percentage of our economy than historically has been the case. Now, candidly, this isn't just a U.S. problem. The EU, the European Commission, issued a report in 2005 noting that because of growing old age dependency ratios, among other things, that there was a quote-unquote a risk of unsustainable public finance emerging in about half of the EU member states. Now, fortunately, the UK was not one of those member states in which the EU report, European Commission report, referred to. But one of the reasons that the UK is not one is because UK's economy, 40% is represented by government. In the United States, it's about 28 to 29%. The U.S. will never be 40 because our culture will not allow for it. Plus, one of the reasons that we've had stronger economic growth is because we've had more disposable income and more invested in the private sector. No doubt that 28 will go up over the years, but it will never reach near 40% in my professional opinion and personal opinion. There's a difference in the scope and the potential impact, however, of the U.S. challenge. We really have four major deficits in the United States right now. The first is our federal budget deficit. Last year, in 2005, we ran a cash-based deficit of $319 billion. Now, to get a feel for that number, you've got to add nine zeros after that 319. You don't really appreciate it until you see the zeros. Now, that's not an all-time record, but it's near a record. It was down about $90 billion from the prior year, but it's still imprudently high. But if you look at the numbers on an accrual basis, which is what the financial statements show and which is what private sector organizations have to show, the deficit didn't go down $90 billion. It went up $144 billion to an all-time record $760 billion. That's an over 30% negative bottom line. An over 30% negative bottom line when we haven't been in a recession since November of 2001. We had among the strongest economic growth rates of any nation on earth last year, at least industrialized nation on earth, and yet we're running deficits of that size. Some would say, well, it's because we're at war, quote-unquote, because Congress has never declared war. But nonetheless, we do face a global conflict, and we do have troops in Afghanistan and in Iraq and other parts of the world. But that's not true, that the deficit is because of the war. Because of the total cost associated with Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as incremental homeland security cost, that only represents about $100 billion out of those much larger numbers that I mentioned before. What's more troubling is that in the last 5 years, from 2000 to 2005, the total liabilities and unfunded commitments of the United States have increased from about $20 trillion, so add 12 zeros behind the 20, to $46 trillion in 5 years. To give you a sense as to what that means $156,000 for every American, including the newest newborn. As they say, no wonder newborn babies cry, because with each birth certificate comes a birth burden certificate of $156,000. Or stated differently, in the United States, most families are dual income families, in part because they want to be, in some cases because they have to be in order to have the standard of living that they want. So that would mean for full-time workers, it's about $375,000 per full-time worker. Dual income family, $750,000 of mortgage with no house. And these numbers are growing every second of every minute of every day. Why? Continuing deficits. Number two, demographic destiny. And number three, compounding interest cost. We've gone from the world's largest creditor nation to the world's largest debtor nation. And when you're a creditor or investor, the miracle of compounding works for you. But when you're a debtor, it works against you. The second deficit that we have is a savings deficit. Too many Americans are following the lead of the federal government and spending more than they take in, as well as adding debt at record rates. And as I mentioned before, for the first time since 1933, our savings rate for Americans was negative for the year. Many Americans are living beyond their means and are deeply in debt, and that's a problem to begin with, especially in an aging society. As I said before, given the inevitability that government social insurance programs will have to be restructured, that means that there's going to be more pressure on individuals to plan, save, invest, and preserve those savings for retirement if they want to have a decent standard of living and live a number of years in retirement. Recent cutbacks in retirement benefits and pension freezes at U.S. major corporations like General Motors, Verizon, Motorola, and IBM underscore the dramatic changes that are occurring, not just within the public sectors, but also the private sector. Who's underwriting America's spending spree? That brings me to the third deficit, and that's our overall balance of payments deficit, of which the trade deficit is a subset. We hit an all-time record in 2005. Overseas money has been pouring into the United States, in part because we still are a great place to invest, and we still are a great country. And in part because other countries and their citizens have been saving to a great extent while we have been dissaving. China, Japan, Korea, and elsewhere have been lending us their excess money at relatively low rates, which has provided us with a false sense of security about where we are and where we ultimately may be headed. After all, with low inflation, with relatively low interest rates, and with reasonable economic growth, things don't look bad today. And in fact, they aren't. They're pretty good today. But the question is, how long will this last? What if those foreign investors decide, for whatever reason, not to disinvest and not to divest, but to not buy as many U.S. government securities merely because of the principle of diversification? If that happens, then it's not a matter of if the United States will end up borrowing. The only question will be, at what interest rate will the United States borrow? And that could start a vicious cycle. Believe me, there's nothing wrong with having foreign players buy U.S. government securities. We're grateful that they do. At the same point in time, one must recognize that the more that we're dependent upon others to finance our excess consumption, the reality is that others hold an increasing percentage of our mortgage, which doesn't exactly reduce our risk. If anything, it increases our risk, and it also reduces our leverage on issues of global interest and concern. The fourth deficit is probably the most serious deficit at all. As I said, a budget deficit, a savings deficit, a balance of payments deficit, of which a trade deficit is a subset. The fourth deficit is probably the most serious of all, and it's a leadership deficit. And that is a nonpartisan, bipartisan statement. We have a problem on both ends of our Pennsylvania Avenue, which runs from the White House to the Capitol. We have a problem on both sides of the hill and both sides of the aisle. We have too many people focused on today, not enough people trying to create a more positive future. We have too many people focused on the next election rather than the next generation. We've had near record increases in spending for the last 40 years, combined with dramatic reductions in taxes. The combined effect is a hemorrhaging bottom line. There is no question, in my view, that you want to minimize tax burdens, At the same point in time, in the final analysis, you need to have enough revenue to pay your current bills and deliver on your future promises. Unfortunately, American businesses have not been active in this discussion and debate about America's fiscal future, even though they were very active in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Now, one can speculate why, but so far they have been largely missing in action. And I would argue this is not in their economic interest over the long term, because if we don't get our fiscal house in order, they're going to pay a price, either with higher borrowing cost, rising tax burdens, and or slower economic growth, which means that their top line will affect as well as their bottom line. We really have the elements of a perfect storm brewing, a combination of ignorance, apathy, and inaction. That's not a good combination. If we continue on our present course, a fiscal crisis is only a matter of time. This should be a matter of concern to the rest of the world, because we are the largest economy in the world, and we do have an impact beyond our borders. Although I may be one of the few voices of the United States stating the facts, speaking the truth, and trying to encourage people to do the right thing, I'm not the only voice. There's a growing chorus of individuals who recognize reality, that recognize that we must act sooner rather than later because time is working against us. From a practical standpoint, this issue won't reach critical mass until the 2008 presidential election, because there's two ways that you engage in dramatic and fundamental reform. Either A, because you have to, because you face a crisis, or B, because you have inspired, committed, and persistent leadership. Personally, I prefer number two to number one. These are not partisan issues. Our problem cannot be laid at the doorsteps of any particular person or any particular party. Even at when we had current surpluses, we face large and growing structural deficits due to known demographic trends, rising health care costs, and other factors over the long term. But unfortunately, those surpluses are long gone. And those who thought that we would pay off our entire debt and wondered what we would do when we did, as I told them in 2001, that's a dream. That's not where we are today, and we need to be able to start getting serious soon. The first order of business is to restore fiscal discipline. We need greater transparency and accountability in our budgeting and financial reporting processes. As the old saying goes, when you're in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. We haven't learned that rule yet. We're still digging at or near record breaks. Americans have shrugged off warnings about deficits and debt for a long time, and we still have some politicians that say deficits don't matter, or we'll grow our way out of this problem. Candidly, anybody who says we'll grow our way out of this problem, number one, hasn't studied economic history, and number two, would probably flunk basic math. Nonetheless, that doesn't keep some from saying it. Deficits do matter, especially if they're large, growing, and structural in nature. I'm the person who has to sign off on the audit report for the financial statements of the United States government. Last year, for the ninth straight year, we disclaimed an opinion on the financial statements, in large part due to problems with our Defense Department, which is unauditable at the present point in time. There are a number of serious control weaknesses. But despite the fact that we did not express an opinion, for the second year in a row, we included an emphasis paragraph noting that the United States has a broken business model and that tough choices have to be made, the sooner the better. I've already given you the numbers, the trillions, the billions, the hundreds of thousands per person or per full-time worker. And as I said before, they're growing every second of every day. A crunch is coming, and we could mitigate and moderate that if we start sooner rather than later. Ultimately, if we don't take drastic steps, higher interest rates and inflation are inevitable. That means that if we have to borrow more money, we'll have less money available to innovate, improve, and stay competitive. That, over the long term, will have an adverse effect on economic growth, American jobs, our standard of living, and ultimately our long-term national security. In the final analysis, we're going to have to reimpose budgetary controls, spending caps. We're going to have to reimpose pay-as-you-go rules on both the tax and spending side of the ledger. We're going to have to implement triggers that force reconsideration of mandatory spending programs that last year represented 61% of the entire budget and going up every year. 61% of the U.S. budget last year was on autopilot. That is not sustainable. We're also going to have to do three things. We're going to have to reform our entitlement programs. That means our social insurance programs for pensions and health. We're going to have to re-engineer the entire base of discretionary spending. And we're going to have to look at tax policy. I don't know about your countries, but I can tell you that a significant majority of United States government spending programs and tax policies are based upon conditions that existed in the United States and in the world in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, and in some cases, the 1970s. Because once things get into the base of spending or tax policy, the presumption is they're okay. And there's a great debate every year about, do we plus this up a little, or do we cut this a little bit, or do we create something new? There's not enough discussion and debate about what's working and what's not working. The United States spends $3 trillion a year, or close to $3 trillion a year, in spending. In addition, it forgoes $700 to $800 billion a year based upon tax preferences. And yet, in most cases, we don't know whether those programs are working or whether they're not working. In part, because we don't have a set of key national indicators to be able to look at economic, safety, security, social, and environmental outcomes to understand how we're doing on an absolute basis, how we're trending, and how we compare to others, to help us understand which programs and policies are working and which ones aren't, and to help us to be able to target limited resources to maximum effect. I'm working, along with my colleagues, with the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development to try to make that a reality around the world, as well as with the National Academies of Sciences and others to try to make that a reality in the United States sooner than around the world. We need it desperately, because otherwise it's like flying a plane blind and without autopilot. Not a positive picture. Our budget processes, as I said, must be reformed, but ultimately tough choices will have to be made. And it's on entitlement reform, spending restructuring and constraint, and tax policy, all three. We're going to have to do something along all three. But the great debate will be how much through spending, how much through revenues, what order, what priority, what approach. But that's what a democracy is all about. At the same point in time, what is clearly unacceptable and unsustainable is to continue our period of denial. We must begin to act. We have published a report recently, which is on our website, and I know that all the students here and faculty and others at LSE are very adept with the internet in technology. It's on our website, which is www.gao.gov. It's called 21st Century Challenges, Reexamining the Base of the Federal Government. This document raises over 200 questions that need to be asked and answered to re-engineer the U.S. government for the 21st century. They're not exhaustive, they're illustrative, and they are thought-stimulating. And quite candidly, I would respectfully suggest they probably apply to many other countries around the world. There are also a series of generic questions that need to be asked about major tax and spending programs in order to reassess them in light of 21st century challenges and realities. In the end, tough choices and definitive actions will be necessary, and I think it's going to take 20 plus years before we're ultimately on a prudent and sustainable path. When you're making tough changes, whether they be in public policy or in internal transformation efforts, you typically have to go from patience to persistence to perseverance to pain before you prevail. But prevail we must. The GAO is the supreme audit institution in the United States. We're sometimes referred to as the congressional watchdog or by other names. We have a normally positive. We normally are the organization that are auditing, investigating, evaluating others. And when I came to GAO in 1998, the agency, due largely to factors beyond its control, was an at-risk agency. And one of the objectives that I had was to take it from being an at-risk agency to a model federal agency, bless you, and a world-class professional services organization that just happened to be in the federal government. And one that led by example and practiced what it preached and led the way on showing others how you can transform yourself to meet the changes and challenges of the 21st century. Our people have risen to the challenge. Our agency is now roughly 100 persons smaller than it was in 1998. We have about 3,200 people. We have doubled our outcomes in many key performance indicators, including return on investment. Last year, as a result of adopting GAO recommendations for improvements in government, there were $40 billion in financial benefits. That's $83 return for every dollar invested in GAO, over double what it was in 1998, number one in the world. I don't know that anybody's even close. But the fact is, we get there because of focusing on results, because of focusing on our clients, focusing on our people, and partnering for progress with others both domestically and internationally around the world. We have knowledge that we can share with others, but quite frankly, we have a lot that we can learn from others as well. Because while the United States may be number one in many things, we are not number one in everything. And as I mentioned to you before, we are down the list on some very important areas like math and science results and healthcare outcomes. So we need to recognize that we have many shared challenges and we must work together. We need to push for global accounting and auditing standards. We need to push to strengthen supreme audit institutions around the world to help combat corruption, speak truth, promote transparency, enhance government performance, and assure accountability for the benefit of citizens wherever they may be. And supreme audit institutions are uniquely positioned to be able to make a positive and lasting difference because they are one of the few institutions in government that are professional, objective, fact-based, nonpartisan, non-ideological, fair, and balanced. And by fair and balanced, that doesn't mean equal positive is negative. It just means don't just focus on the negative. Recognize that there are positive things that should be acknowledged and focused on, not just the negative. For example, Hurricane Katrina. The federal government, in the aggregate, did not do a good job. But there are certain federal agencies that did an excellent job, including the Coast Guard. So it's important that we not just focus on what went wrong. We need to understand what went wrong. We need to learn from it. We need to make recommendations to improve it. But we need to acknowledge what went right. Because in the final analysis, if we want the public to have confidence in their government, they need to understand that their government can do things well and that there are certain things that, quite frankly, only government will do. You cannot ask nor expect the private sector to do certain things. Government is focused on the greater good. That is not the responsibility, nor will it ever be, of the private sector, even though that's the engine of growth and innovation in our economy. So we need to focus more on leading by example. We need to help focus on three areas: oversight, insight, and foresight. Is the money being spent for the intended purpose in compliance with laws and regulation? That's oversight. Insight: what works and what doesn't work? Which programs work and which policies work and which ones don't work? And foresight: what are the emerging trends and challenges facing our countries and its position in the world, and how can we help policymakers make more timely and informed judgments before they reach crisis proportions? In summary, because I want to leave plenty of time for Q&A, as I mentioned before, for any system to work, you have to have three things: incentives for people to do the right thing, transparency to provide reasonable assurance they will do the right thing, and accountability if they do the wrong thing. Many people in government say they want truth, say they want transparency, and say they want accountability until it relates to them. We had a president in the 1940s and early 1950s called Harry Truman, right after World War II. And he had a nickname called Give 'em Hell Harry, because he had a reputation of telling it like it is. And when somebody asked him one day, how did he get his nickname, he said, I never give anybody hell. I just tell them the truth and they think it's hell. It's critically important, especially in a democracy, that there be truth tellers and that there be adequate transparency, because otherwise we will all pay a big price. Sometimes the U.S. is known to dither and dally and delay. And Winston Churchill had to coax us quite a bit before we got involved in the great conflict that became World War II. But the United States has a history of once we get behind an issue and once we wake up, watch out. The United States has faced many challenges in the past. We have risen to these challenges. We have had a long-standing history of every generation leaving our country not only better positioned today than when the generation came, but better positioned for the future. Not only better off today, but better positioned for the future. That long-standing tradition, however, because of our fiscal imprudence, is at risk. And we will not be alone in sharing the adverse consequences of that risk if we do not get our act together. In America, we need leaders in the public sector, private sector, not-for-profit sector, and I'm going to guess that a certain other countries do too, although I won't mention any names because I'm beyond my borders, that share four key attributes: courage, integrity, creativity, and stewardship. By courage, I mean individuals, leaders in the public sector, private sector, not-for-profit sector, including academia, who have the courage to state the facts, speak the truth, tell it like it is, and do the right thing, even though it may not be popular and even though it may be countercultural. We need leaders who have the integrity to practice what they preach and to lead by example, leaders who understand that the law represents the floor of acceptable behavior, not the desired state, who have higher moral and ethical standards that they strive to meet. Leaders who are creative, who can help find innovative solutions to addressing old problems and can help others see the way forward. And finally, leaders who take their stewardship responsibility seriously, who understand that as a steward of the public trust, or whatever their responsibilities might be, a corporation or a not-for-profit entity, that they have a responsibility not just to maximize results today, they have a responsibility to leave things better off when they came than when they arrived, but also better positioned for the future. History provides numerous examples of countries that took different paths. One example is Argentina, a country that before World War II was one of the most prosperous nations in Latin America. Argentina lost its way, had the largest default of any country in history, and has suffered economically as well as its people suffering as well. That's one path, not a path that I want the United States or other countries to take. Another path is New Zealand, who came to the verge of bankruptcy, got hold of itself, came to its senses, took tough actions, and is now come back from the brink and is poised to be able to have a positive future not only for its country, but also for its citizens. We need to recognize that whether you live in Washington, London, or Beijing, we're increasingly in the same boat. No country can or should go it alone in today's world. We need to partner for progress. The choice is simple. We either start rowing together or we risk sinking separately. As a republic, no republic in the history of the world has lasted more than a little over 500 years. Rome as an empire lasted over 1,000, but less than half of the, well, about half of that as a republic. There are several reasons that Rome did not last as a republic, but three seem pretty relevant today. First, declining moral values and political comedy, ITY, at home. Secondly, overconfidence and overextension around the world. And number three, fiscal irresponsibility by the central government. One must recognize that those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. The good news is, as I said before, the United States has faced major challenges in the past. I believe we can, we must, and we will rise to this challenge. We just need to do it sooner rather than later. And it's not just our fate, but the fate of many others that are dependent upon us doing so. The sooner we act, the less dramatic the changes have to be, and the more time that we'll have to adjust to those changes. And in closing, let me just say that while the numbers I've given you are big numbers and bad numbers, that this is not just about numbers. It's also about values. And for me, when I try to put a face on this, the faces that I put on it are my two children and my three grandchildren. I'm not worried about me or my wife, and I'm not as worried about our two children. I'm very concerned about our three grandchildren. I'm very concerned about the burden that they will bear based upon the course that we're on. And they can't vote. And by the time they can vote, it may be too late. So, it's not just about numbers, it's about values. And I appreciate your time and attention, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Right, well, let's go to queries and questions, and one right at the back there.
My name is David Harrington. I'm a member of the public. Have you ever considered running for office?
Right now, I have a good job. The good thing about my job right now is I have a 15-year term, of which I have about half left. I don't have to raise money, and I have 3,200 of some of the brightest and most dedicated people you can imagine, and I can make a big difference in just about any area that I choose. So in the short term, the answer is no. I've been recruited in the past, but I've resisted so far.
Question over there.
Hi, Corey Balls from Dow Jones Newswires. There's a lot of pressure, both publicly and privately, from U.S. government officials on the Chinese government to raise the artificially low level of the yuan. What about the implications for that on the U.S. current account deficit? I mean, an obvious consequence could very well be that the Chinese stop buying treasuries in such a vast amount.
Well, as you know, the Chinese have taken some steps, and I think over time there will be an easing there. You're coming back to the point that I said before. I don't think that we should be blaming others for our problems. And I think that hopefully things will end up moderating themselves over time. But to the extent that we are not saving on our own and we have to rely upon others to a greater extent to finance our excess consumption, that means that we lose control over part of our own destiny, and it means that we have less leverage over those entities. Or stated differently, they have more leverage over us. And that's just simple reality. It's amazing how many people don't recognize that reality, though.
Thank you. Paolo De Renzi is my name. I work with a non-profit entity called the Overseas Development Institute. And I have three very, very short questions, and then you can choose which one to answer or if you want to answer them all. The first one is, you paint a very bleak picture where I assume that everything you said here, you also say in the reports that you send to the U.S. Congress. But you said in the Congress there's hardly anybody who is willing to listen to you. There's a lack of leadership. There's a private sector which is also not participating in this debate. So when you say we should change, we should do this, we should do that, who is we? Who are your allies? And mm-hmm. What are some of the dynamics that might allow a step change to take place? Number two, when you talk about the sort of upcoming fiscal crisis will come no matter what you say, it's just a matter of time. Do you think internal factors will be more important than external factors? I mean, will it be basically the lack of capacity of the U.S. government sort of reining the deficit, or will it be again sort of the Chinese determining the fate of the U.S. Economy or the impending fiscal crisis? That's number two. Number three is part of my job is kind of advising developing country governments on how to improve their public financial management system and supreme audit institutions in different countries. And the way you describe the part of, the way in which the U.S. government functions actually almost sounds like a developing country. When you say, we don't have performance indicators that allow us to decide if money is being well spent. There are departments where we cannot really audit the accounts, and we have a leadership which is is not willing to take hard choices and just sort of runs huge deficits. So if we can't look up to the U.S. government to sort of do things right, which other countries can we look up to in terms of looking for better systems and for better ways of doing things? When we advise developing country governments, apart from telling them that the Government Accountability Office is a very good institution. Thank you.
First, who are we? There are more members of Congress on both sides of the aisle that are increasingly concerned about this issue, and their numbers are increasing with time, but they are nowhere close to a majority yet. As we all know, when you're going to make tough choices that involve dramatic and fundamental change, the first thing you have to do is get to the point where a majority of the people recognize that that action is necessary and it's prudent to take it sooner rather than later. We're making progress, but we're not there yet. Secondly, there's a coalition of groups that have come together, which is being added to all the time, that are not only getting the message out within Washington, but also in town hall meetings around the country. I participated in 5 with this coalition so far. We've got about 8 more scheduled. We've got about 10 other cities on the waiting list. And I expect that this will end up going all the way up to and through the 2008 presidential elections. In the United States,
The history is these types of issues get nationalized as part of presidential elections. The last time that we had a major public debate on this issue was when Ross Perot ran for president. He didn't win, but he took this to the people. The people got it. And even though he didn't win, the president did have to take it seriously, and there were actions that were taken to get us on a more prudent and sustainable path. With regard to internal versus external factors, we have an ability to control our own destiny. We can get our act together and start making some tough choices, doing it sooner rather than later, and take pressure off of the external pressures. I believe we will eventually do it. I just hope that we do it sooner rather than later. The fact is under the traditional measures of what would cause a crisis, those don't manifest themselves. Like, when do the trust funds run dry for, you know, Social Security or whatever? Those are misleading and measures, but they're traditional measures. I think the greatest risk is from the outside. But on the other hand, we can reduce that risk if we do take prudent steps soon ourselves, and that's what we should do. With regard to developing countries, look, the United States does a lot of things great. Okay? I mean, we're the world's oldest democracy. We're the world's longest continuing republic today. We do have stronger economic growth than most other industrialized nations. We do have low unemployment rates as compared to most other industrialized nations. You know, we do have a higher standard of living than most other industrialized nations. I mean, we've got a lot of things we do well, all right? My point is, we've got a lot of things we should be doing better. And so we should not assume that we are number one, and we should seek to improve and continuously improve. So there are a lot of things that others can learn from us. But I'll give you another angle on the developing nations. We're not the only country that faces this problem. And in fact, in many cases, others have a more serious problem. We're just more honest and open about it. We're more transparent about it. Okay? I don't want to get penalized because we're more honest and open. In fact, the reason that I'm doing this is to help elected officials be able to make tough choices, because realistically, they're not going to be able to make tough choices unless the people understand that tough choices are necessary, because they want to get reelected, right? I mean, you know, it's understandable. Another consequence could be, if the developed world doesn't get its act together, that will have an adverse effect on the developing world, because that means that they will have less resources available, less ability and willingness to be able to help those. And one of the things that we face in this world today is growing gaps between the haves and have-nots. That's a reality.
Michael Barzilay, a professor here at the LSC. I want to come back to accountability as a topic. I've heard a friend of mine who's a three-star general be quite concerned that in the executive branch, in particular the Department of Defense, accountability isn't what it used to be. The practice of accountability isn't what it used to be. And given the new name of your agency, I'm just wondering if the GAO did a general management review of the executive branch today, how would it fare in terms of the
DOD? I'll give you a direct answer. Is that your question?
Yeah.
DOD is number one in the world in fighting and winning armed conflicts. Nobody's close. UK obviously does well too, all right? That's why they're in business, right? They're in business for outcomes when we need them. They are a D, poor, graded on a curve, giving them a benefit of the doubt for economy, efficiency, transparency, and accountability. And they waste billions and billions and billions of dollars every year. They have 14 of 25 high-risk areas on GAO's high-risk list. And in many cases, it's not because they have bad people. They have very good and dedicated people. They have bad systems. They need a fundamental cultural transformation. They have way too many layers, way too many players, way too many hardened silos, way too many legacy, non-integrated information systems, you know, on which to make decisions. They need tough love. And they need more accountability. And we're trying to help give it to them.
My name is Katrin Höckel. I'm a master's student here at LSE. My question concerns the second deficit you mentioned, the savings deficit. And you mentioned it right after the public or the government deficit. And do you think these two things could be linked in a sense that the government is somehow giving the wrong signals or is a bad model in terms of overspending? And if not, what do you think is the main reason for this savings deficit?
The government is not leading by example. The government can't exactly lecture to its citizens to say you shouldn't be doing what you're doing when all they're doing is following the lead of the government. Look, Americans are great at spending. You know, I mean, we're great at spending. We can spend with the best of them, okay? But we're not great at saving. And part of it is that we have a false sense of security. You know, we've always been, you know, in recent modern history, we've been number one, you know, economically. We've had strong economic growth. We now have relatively low inflation. We have pretty modest inflation rates. You know, home equity has continued to go up. And as a result, people have always assumed that things are just going to get better. You know, look at the ads in America. You know, buy this and don't pay for another year. You know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, I would venture to say that a lot of you have credit cards. I know when I took my son to Villanova, which is the Notre Dame of the East in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, when I took him to register when he was a freshman several years ago, there were all kinds of credit card companies there wanting to give him to sign up. He could have signed up for four or five credit cards, all right, and he didn't have any money other than what we gave him, all right? And so part of it is that we have a consumption, a credit-oriented society, which as long as interest rates are low and as long as, you know, home equity is going up, people feel okay. But interest rates don't stay low forever, and home equity doesn't continue to go up at the kind of rates we've had them going up lately. So, you know, in fact, one of the concerns that I have is in America, over 40% of the new home mortgages are interest-only variable rate mortgages, and a significant percentage of new home purchases in the United States over the last couple of years are not for occupying, therefore speculation, therefore investment, all right? So I think one of the things it's going to take is that for people to understand that government programs aren't going to get restructured. And if they want to retire at a reasonably early age, they're going to need to plan, save, invest, and preserve those savings for retirement. And we're going to have a lot more public education on saving, the benefits of that, the need for that, and also how much you have to save in order to attain a certain and maintain a certain standard of living in retirement. You know, there are a lot of people who plan for their first year of retirement. They forget about something called inflation. You know, if you're on a fixed income that's not indexed, that, you know, and you want to be in retirement for a number of years, that gets eat away at pretty quick because of the miracle of compounding working against you because of the stealth tax, and the stealth tax is inflation.
Maybe one last question. This gentleman here, please.
Yes, just really follows on from the previous question. I mean, given the American aversion to taxation and the difficulty politically of increasing taxes, it seems likely that the approach to cutting the budget deficit is probably going to be more through cutting spending rather than raising taxes. The approach to raising the private sector savings rate presumably is going to involve continuing increases in interest rates. There must be some concern if these two things do, as you say, in fact will happen at some point, that you'll find yourselves in a Japanese-type situation with an economy that starts going into recession and paradoxically then pushes the budget deficit up even higher. And I just wonder what you think about those risks and whether in the long, long haul, America may have to inflate its way out of these problems.
Well, that is obviously one possible scenario. It's one that I hope that we can avoid. I will tell you this. I do believe that we're going to do all three things that I said. we're going to restructure entitlement programs, and Social Security is easy. I could write on the back of an envelope in 3 minutes how to restructure Social Security, and it'd exceed the expectations of every generation of Americans. All right, healthcare is a lot tougher, but ultimately we're going to see federal revenues as a higher percentage of GDP than it is right now, and it'll be a materially higher percentage than it is right now. It won't be anywhere close to Europe because of our culture and because of our desire to make sure that we can maintain as much investment as possible in the private sector, to have more disposable income, and you know, that's one of our competitive advantages, quite frankly. It will be materially higher than it is today. I understand materiality for a CPA means 5% or more, so don't run off and print something that's going to be double or whatever. But you know, there are not many Americans that like taxes. But on the other hand, most Americans understand that over the long term, you got to be able to have enough revenue to pay your current bills and deliver on your future promises. And yet, I think we're going to have to do all three, as I said before.
Well, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a reception on the fifth floor in the senior common room. You're all warmly invited to come along. In order to get there, you need to take a lift, which is sometimes difficult in LSE, get to the fifth floor, walk through the senior dining room, where there may or may not be another distracting reception, and reach the senior common room, which has a very high ceiling. That will tell you you're there when you arrive. So you're all very welcome to come. And it remains for me to say to Mr. Walker, thanks very much for a really entertaining and important speech, and perhaps we can just show our appreciation.